I happened to read through an article today, having nothing to do with Walker Percy, called Science Fiction Fantasy and the Writer's Discipline. And the point of the article is that no matter what kind of writing you're doing, you've got to be striving for the truth of some kind, even if you're writing fantasy. He mentions Tolkien. I'm not going to go into that, but if you're interested in Tolkien, you might be interested in this brief little thing that he mentions about Tolkien. And then he says that even if you're describing something that's false, you still have to choose between one word and another, you know, to try to describe it the best way you can. And then he closes with this paragraph. A writer has a job to do. He's driven by a necessity to write. Exploration of the nature of his job involves a rigorous concentration upon the effort to speak the truth. Acceptance of the vocation of writing increases pride, self-consciousness, vanity, detachment, honesty, and subtlety, and brings a man to the point where he topples on the edge of a hole through into another world. And that is the point which matters, because unless this world is shot through with light from another, it is not real. So let that other world be real. That's it. This is in the Crescent magazine. It's an article by J.B. Pick, who is a writer, and also is director of a men's knitwear manufacturing company. When I read that, I thought, But then I read the article anyway, and I'm glad for that last thing, that the world has to have, let that other world have light, you know, let the world have light from another world. It's ambiguous which world is shedding light on which. I'm sure that he's talking about let the imaginative world have light from the real world shown into it for it to be real. And that ties in with what Percy's doing here. Another thing on light. I've got in my room I've got a light that's got a globe around it, and in the middle up on the ceiling. And then over on one of the walls I've taken the shade off of one of those over the bed lights, you know, so that the bulb is just a bare bulb, because that way I get a little more light on my book when I'm reading, and you know, the light is more intense. And one day I happened to look up when I had both of those lights turned on. I looked up and I saw, to my astonishment, that the light in the middle of the room was casting a shadow. There's a shadow on the ceiling cast by the globe of that light, you know, from the other one. Because the other one is that light of greater intensity. I never realized before that a light could cast a shadow, but that's what's happening. It's amazing. The light behind has got more intensity than the one in the middle of the room, you know. So, I don't know. If there's any light around here, and if there are a few shadows around, maybe it's because there's a brighter light somewhere. We've been reading in Corinthians and elsewhere about about the pointlessness of the wisdom of man and how God makes man's wisdom foolish and so on. And so let that be a prefatory thing too. And finally, something that I was thinking about, and I may try to use it in a Vespers, but if I wait that long, I may forget it too. But there's a saying in John when Jesus is talking, in the Gospel according to John, when Jesus is talking about himself being the good shepherd. He speaks how he's leading his sheep and how the sheep know his voice and that. And he says about the sheep, they shall go in and out and find pasturage. And that passage has always intrigued me, that the sheep of Jesus will go in and out and find pasture. And I don't know what it means, but one thing that it sort of means to me lately is that we get caught up in Jesus, and then we go hither and thither, we look inside, we look outside, maybe that's what in and out means, or maybe it means something else, but wherever, we're going here and there, and we find pasture. We get good things to eat, stuff is given to us, you know, wherever we may be roaming. And so maybe this book or any other, you know, Becker, who knows where, you know, lately I might be getting it, you might be finding it somewhere else, but it's a great promise, I'm sure, even though I'm not sure that I understand it.
The ultimate secret for the out is thrown, is that we're led in to the fold, and we're thrown out. And I guess the word is the same as if somebody would be thrown out of the bar. Or thrown. So, right?
Sort of like a comet in orbit or something. To introduce Percy, I thought I would do a little bit from chapter 5, which he calls Notes for a Novel About the End of the World. in which he talks a little bit about his own Christian standing. He doesn't put it first in the book, but I will, just, I don't know, for some reason. He speaks about what a novelist is, and he says that the novelist is not a prophet. He's not got a calling to proclaim the truth, you know, in a very special way like that, at least not the truth of God. He's not wiser than other people. He says, in fact, it might be that a novelist has an affliction which sets him apart and gives him an odd point of view. The wounded man has a better view of the battle than those still shooting. That's a quote. He also says, the novelist is like is less like a prophet than he is like the canary that coal miners used to take down into the shaft to test the air. When the canary gets unhappy, utters plaintive cries, and collapses, it may be time for the miners to surface and think things over. Similarly, he says the postmodern novel is in that sort of a stance to the world of the writer. He says that people complain to him because they say you're always groaning, or you're making things out to be so terrible. He says the novelist and the general reader agree about the nuclear threat, but when the novelist begins behaving like a man teetering on the brink of the abyss here and now, or worse, like a man who is already over the brink and into the abyss, the reader often gets upset and even angry. He says the reader is offended. People are always asking, why don't you write about pleasant things and normal people? Why all the neurosis and violence? There are many nice things in the world. He says, but if one replies, yes, it's true. In fact, there seems to be more nice people around now than ever before. But somehow, as the world grows nicer, it also grows more violent. The triumphant secular society of the Western world, the nicest of all worlds, killed more people in the first half of this century than have been killed in all history. Travelers to Germany before the last war reported that the Germans were the nicest people in Europe. Mm-hmm. To which he says, then the reader is even more offended. You know, he's a sort of a rascal. He says that the novelist, unlike the new theologian, is one of the few remaining witnesses to the doctrine of original sin, the imminence of catastrophe in paradise. He comes at that in a little better way in another place. He says, concerning what he's about, he says the question is not whether the good news is no longer relevant, but rather whether it is possible that man is presently undergoing a tempestuous restructuring of his consciousness, which does not presently allow him to take account of the good news. I'm not sure I agree with that, that it's because our consciousness is changing due to the end of the modern age, which he says has happened, and the beginning of the postmodern age, in which everything is up for grabs. I think there's a good deal of truth to that. I'm not sure that that's the problem with the proclamation. But still, he is striving with that, and I think that's a significant statement for what he's doing. He would agree with that. I don't think he's saying that quite that way, though. He says that man is split. He says right now we're split, and I can mention this now, but it'll come up again when I go back to the beginning and start coming through with him. But he talks about how there's an objective kind of a consciousness, which he calls science, and the scientific method, and then our everyday earth selves, which have become basically consumers. So we're split between sort of a rarefied objectivism on the one hand, and on the other hand, we're consumers who have needs satisfied by this nice world we're in. And we're torn in this split. And there's all sorts of problems. Well, I guess I'll go back to the beginning, because otherwise we're starting too much in the middle of his story. He starts out by asking a whole bunch of questions. It goes on for page after page, and I'll just give you a sample of a few. The very first thing he says, why does man feel so sad in the 20th century? Why does man feel so bad in the very age when, more than in any other age, he has succeeded in satisfying his needs and making over the world for his own use? Why do people often feel bad in good environments and good in bad environments? Why is it that the only time I ever saw my uncle happy during his entire life was the afternoon of December 7th, 1941, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor? Why did he shortly thereafter become miserable when he learned that he was too old to go to Europe to shoot at Germans and stand a good chance of being shot by Germans? Why is it that the only time he was happy before was in the Argonne Forest in 1918 when he was shooting at Germans and stood a good chance of being shot by Germans? He says, what is the difference between a man, a commuter who feels bad without knowing why, and another commuter who feels bad without knowing why, but who begins to read a book about a man who feels bad without knowing why? Why does it make a man feel better to read a book about a man like himself feeling bad? Why was it that Jean-Paul Sartre, sitting in a French cafe and writing Nausea, which is about the absurdity of human existence and the nausea of life in the 20th century, why was he the happiest man in France at the time? Why was it that when Franz Kafka would read aloud to his friends stories about the sadness and alienation of life in the 20th century, everyone would laugh until tears came? He mentions this several times. Kafka used to read his stories to his friends and they would all just laugh uproariously. I haven't heard much of Kafka, but I think that's rather remarkable. So he says our theories of understanding man don't work anymore. Because he says, obviously, man is not only an organism and an environment, because the environment, technically, should be just right. But something is wrong. And so we're not looking deeply enough. And for anyone, and I'm saying this especially for John, but for anyone who wants to read a critique of behaviorism as an explanation of man, this book will give you all sorts of material. And yet, he's not anti-science. And he'll even grant that behaviorism has some things to say, but only if it's put in a proper framework, and that framework is rather small. Certainly does not address itself to man. It addresses itself to organisms, to creatures. And insofar as man is such, behaviorism has something to say. But insofar as man is something else, which is what the whole book is trying to show, behaviorism just won't cut it. That comes up again and again.
It's a lot like Becker, who was a behavioral psychologist. He began there and ended up in Kierkegaard.
He mentions Kierkegaard, and this guy that interviewed him was very pleased about his knowledge, Percy's knowledge of Kierkegaard. So that was just a little thing that John had seen in an interview. He says, he's speaking about how we lose sovereignty of our experience. This is his first sort of, I think I'll put that off until I get to the second chapter. I'll just read this thing, but we'll come back to it. Everything is too important to be left to the specialist of that thing. It just won't do. I remember now the reason I wanted to read this is because I'm not a specialist. He is not a specialist in this. And I assume that no one here is really a specialist in language, linguistics, or whatever. But he says, everything is too important to be left to the specialist of that thing. And the layman is already too deprived by the surrendering of such sovereignty. So, you know, hang in there with him and try to, you know, see what he's doing. He says, the psychologist draws these little stimulus and response arrows to try to describe communication. And he says that also won't hold to describe language. Another linguist, a theoretician, Noam Chomsky, has given up on describing how language happens, and he says he indicates the central phenomenon of language by a black box, contents unknown, labeled LAD, the language acquisition device, and that's as far as he'll go. Percy wants to go a little beyond that in talking about what language is and you know what it's about, but he himself will not come right down. And, you know, he'll never be able to perhaps define it. He says about behaviorism and science trying to talk about man. Instead of having behaviorists trying to explain language by stimulus response theory, why not try to account for behaviorists by a larger theory of language? He says this over and over again. Instead of trying to be a scientist and with current methodology to describe language or man, he says this gets you into an impasse. Later on in the book, he writes an entire chapter on the impasse that science gets into, current science, current methodology, in trying to define or discover man and language. But he says one thing we can do, and that is, if we want to talk about observing something, let's observe science itself. Let's observe the scientists at work. This is something the scientists themselves cannot do because being men, they're beyond the pale of their own studies. at that critical point, at the critical point of what man is. Now, that's a tension point, and I don't know if I can leave it at that point. I feel like I have to go. I think I'll go to his story about Helen Keller, and then we can back up a little bit, because this is sort of this is the first explosion in the book for me. He says of Helen Keller that she had learned at the age of nine. By the age of nine, she had learned to respond like any good animal. When she wanted a piece of cake, she spelled the word in Miss Sullivan's hand. They had a system of signals they would tap back and forth into each other's hand to spell out words. She had learned that when she wanted a piece of cake, she spelled the words in Miss Sullivan's hand, and Miss Sullivan fetched her the cake, and she could, you know, eat the cake. He compares this to the chimpanzees that are taught to sign for things, like when they want water, they will make a sign for water, or when they want to go outside, they'll make a different sign for going outside. This is what the animal can learn to do. And Helen Keller had learned to do this. He says, then Miss Sullivan took her for a walk. Now this quote is from Helen Keller's autobiography. We walked down the path to the well house, attracted by the fragrance of the honeysuckle with which it was covered. Someone was drawing water, and my teacher placed my hand under the spout. As the cool stream gushed over one hand, she spelled into the other the word water, first slowly, then rapidly. I stood still, my whole attention fixed upon the motion of her fingers. Suddenly I felt a misty consciousness as of something forgotten, a thrill of returning thought, and somehow the mystery of language was revealed to me. I knew then that W-A-T-E-R meant the wonderful, cool something that was flowing over my hand. That living word awakened my soul, gave it light, hope, joy, set it free. There were barriers still, it is true, but barriers that could in time be swept away. I left the well house eager to learn. Everything had a name, and each name gave birth to a new thought. As we returned to the house, every object which I touched seemed to quiver with life. That was because I saw everything with the strange new sight that had come to me. On entering the door, I remembered the doll I had broken. She had earlier destroyed the doll in a fit of temper. I felt my way to the hearth and picked up the pieces. I tried vainly to put them together. Then my eyes filled with tears, for I realized what I had done, and for the first time I felt repentance and sorrow. I learned a great many new words that day. I do not remember what they all were, but I do know that mother, father, sister, teacher were among them. Words that were to make the world blossom for me, like Aaron's rod with flowers. It would have been difficult to find a happier child than I was, as I lay in my crib at the close of that eventful day and lived over the joys it had brought me, and for the first time longed for a new day to come. Isn't that a beautiful passage? Now that's a religious conversion, I think. And that is the seed that set this guy to ask what language is about. Language, he says, is more than a sign. The word is more than a sign, which simply points to a piece of cake and says, I want some cake, or, you know, I like cake, or something. I mean, it, in fact, to say that would be to say something more, but simply to spell out cake and get cake. He says a chimpanzee can do that, but this is something different. And I love Helen's phrase, that living word. I mean, things are loaded for me, you know, because I'm reading things in a different context, and maybe you hear it in a different context, you know. This is the living word somehow. This is a word that is between people who are akin to God. Now, Percy's not saying this, but I am. That's the meaning I get from this. He says it sometimes too. He says, Helen made her breakthrough from the good responding animal which behaviorists study so successfully to the strange name-giving and sentence-uttering creature who begins by naming shoes and ships and sealing wax and later tells jokes, curses, reads the paper, ever becomes a Hegel and composes an entire system of philosophy. It was, this passage really bowled me over. And he talks about how he tried to grasp this with his own familiar systems of language, how he tried to draw an arrow from the water itself that was coming over her hand, and from the spelling of the word water, how these arrows came to Helen and somehow got tied up. But it's not a stimulus and response, because for one thing, both things happened at the same time. It was the tying together of that word, that spelling of those letters, and that stuff that was flowing over her hand. He says that were somehow coupled together, and naming is a coupling. There's nothing inherent in W-A-T-E-R that makes it mean that stuff that was flowing over Helen's hand. And yet, that is water. And he later on, he laughs at the semanticists who rage and roar because they say that water, he says that one guy, Korzybski or somebody, would hold up a pencil and say, whatever you say about this pencil, don't say it is a pencil. Pencil is sounds coming out of our mouth, see? But this thing is something else. But he says, no, that won't wash, Percy says. That won't go, because everything we're doing in language, is tied up with saying things like that, and with making analogies, and with metaphor. And he says, it's the greatest of foolishness for the scientists to say, you're wrong when you say that, because we're saying it all the time, and the scientist himself is saying it all the time, even. He himself is making assertions, and he expects those assertions to be understood by other scientists so they can check him out on it. But you ask him to talk about that, and then he'll give you what he calls time-space things. Little arrows happen, you know. This leads to that. This leads to that. Something else gets another response, and that's how communication is explained. In one place he says, what's our view of man? He's a higher organism, most of us would say. And what is language? Well, you know, sounds come out of my mouth. They go through the air in waves. They hit your eardrum. Vibrations are changed to electrical impulses. The electrical impulses go up into the brain and stimulate something up there, and you understand. But that's precisely what you can't say, because understanding is not a time-space event. Understanding is something else that's going on. Understanding is what happened to Helen when suddenly a misty consciousness as of thought returning. How in the world do you understand that? What, you know, what could that be? But that's the way she describes it, a misty consciousness as of thought returning. As of something forgotten, a thrill of returning thought, and somehow the language, you know, and the water were tied together. This is an incredible thing. He calls this the Delta phenomenon, and he says that if the scientists are right, and that ontogeny does recapitulate phylogeny. How many of you have heard that phrase? Ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. It means that the development of an individual mirrors or reproduces in some way the development of the phylum. I'll probably murder this, people, but an example I remember is that the embryo human at one stage in development has gills, or so it's said. Maybe this isn't even current anymore, but it doesn't make any difference for the argument. The point is that maybe our ancestors at some time had gills too, and ontogeny, our development, the development of the individual, recapitulates the development of the human being. Anyway, there are no doubt more authoritative examples of that. He calls it the biologist's motto. But anyway, he says, if that happens, then Helen's breakthrough must bear some relation to the breakthrough of the species itself. He says, usually this happens when the child is two, maybe, you know, around the age of two. Suddenly naming begins to happen, you know. What's that? What's that? What's that? You know? And the name becomes the thing somehow. It's the structuring of it, see? But with her, it happened when she was nine. And suddenly she packed into, you know, a few days or weeks what normal child takes a year maybe to do. You know, it just was a tremendous, just a breakthrough when this thing happened. And not only that, but she remembers it. You know, could talk about it. And so then he's thinking, he's saying these our ancestors, having harnessed fire for the first time, seated around the embers, looking into the eyes of the comrades and thinking, not really thinking, of course, about the vivid events of the day's hunt and, quote, knowing, unquote, that the others must be, quote, thinking, unquote, about the same thing. One of them tries to recapture, to savor it, and so repeats the crude hunting cry, meaning bison here. In other words, they already know how to, you know, when one sees bison, he already knows how to go, wah! And everybody goes, yeah, you know, they all run over there with their spears. They know what that means, right? The chimpanzee can do that. And he says his friends know that. That he doesn't mean get up and hunt now. Or do this or that thing. They know that he doesn't mean that, you know. Something else is meant, see. He said, and it means something like, remember him, remember the bison. He says, and as the other waits and sees it, sees the bison, savors the seeing it, something happens, a spark jumps. Man. He said, this has got to be the minimum definition of man. I'm going to skip a whole bunch of stuff I was going to do, but I'll ask it, is there even enough unity at this point to ask if there are questions or what? Or comments, or do I just go ahead? He talks about naming, too, a little more.
I'll go on. One thing, does he say anything about how that might, when she said water, that might have been the last time she could say it in a word?
What I think you're saying is that she couldn't go back anymore to the other way of just making signs, in a sense. Now, it was different. Huh?
It's like, Rilke has a line about the poem seeks the verbal equivalence of vision. For her, anyway, that happened.
Mm-hmm.
At that moment. After that happened, the water, it took more words than that.
Yeah, it could be.
Because, yeah, because for her the counter water was filled with volume. Association did that. Since language caught up to reality. And at that moment, I think that, like, the way I look at it, in heaven I'll be able to say 10 things at the same time.
Yeah.
And after that first, you know, the equivalence. The closest thing I can come to it is when I am intensely desiring to say something true to someone else, and I'm searching for the word on the tip of my tongue, and almost shaking, and then it comes. And that, when that word comes, there's that same slap, the verbal equivalence of the vision, the one word, the verbal equivalence. And there, I don't know if there's a joy. Well, you know, but, you know, what do you got? Linguistic orgasm or something? what? But it's that kind of thing. But I was just wondering if he mentioned, you know, that Helen. I mean, that was in the sense of a metaphor, and then after that, she may have had to go to metaphor.
Yep.
To say water.
With reference to her, he doesn't say that. But what he does say is that, and something I haven't even mentioned yet nor read, is that naming is sort of the primitive act. It's the first act, and it's for him sort of the base unit of this thing. But something that follows close behind it, and which is much more of a flowering thing, is the sentence. Water is cool. Water is wet. Or a nonsense sentence, like water is upside down or something. I mean, he talks about those possibilities. I think in that sense, he's reflecting on what you're saying. That the sentence is, he says the word really, even that naming right then, is to say, this is water, or that is water. I mean, it took the sentence. He says the sentence is the basic unit of meaning, not the word. And so what Helen felt that moment, or learned, or knew at that moment, was that stuff is water. And later on, water is cool, water, you know, is whatever it is.
Maybe what she meant is that water is.
Well, I think maybe he would agree with that. I think perhaps he would agree with that. Because when she walked out of the well house, after all, suddenly everything had a name, you know. It was like a whole new world, this new sight, she calls it, had come. And the doll now existed too. Imagine that. Someone help me with that. What does that mean? She remembered her doll that she had broken, and she went and picked it up and tried to put it together, and wept when she couldn't, and says for the first time she felt sorrow and repentance because she knew what she had done.
Well, she learned that water is, you know, that everything else doesn't know. She obviously learned being outside mm-hmm. of herself, which Helen Keller never could have known before.
Mm-hmm.
know. So then, yes, there was something that had happened to the doll, and it was important. Before it wasn't important because the doll was nothing. Mm-hmm. It was a nothing.
So it's like she discovered the world.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe that.
I know, isn't that something?
Journey's chapter.
When someone says being, I resonate with Percy with that, because he definitely talks about. He closes up this chapter on you know, in which he talks about Helen Keller, by talking about this phenomenon, this naming phenomenon, this spark, as the delta factor, and he speaks of it as, you know, at the beginning was alpha and at the end will be omega, but along at delta came man, and this is, you know, the appearance of man, this electricity, this naming. And I'm going to have to get a watch out here. Yeah, that's what I was afraid of. It goes even more slowly than I feared. He speaks of the daylight of language. And he says, in the beginning was alpha, the end is omega, but somewhere in came delta, man himself. Man became man by breaking into the daylight of language, whether by good fortune or bad fortune, whether by pure chance, the spark jumping the gap because the gap was narrow enough, or by the touch of God. It is not for me to say here. But it happened. And to this day, man knows less about what happened than he knows about the backside of the moon. And so that's what he wants to talk about. He talks a lot about how if you try to track down this phenomenon, and you talk to linguists, and you talk to phenomenologists, and you talk to anthropologists, and you talk to all these people, nobody can tell you about what happened there. Because it doesn't fit into behaviorism. And if you go the way of German idealism, you end up with a little island. In other words, the thing that happened within Helen was not something that happened only within Helen. Because before, Helen was, you know, she was a contained unit, all right, even though she didn't know it. But what happened was, suddenly, her world was in touch, and she learned mother, father, sister, teacher, doll, water, and that everything had a name. And that's what the scientists can't talk about, because it's not a time-space event. It's a real event, he says, but it's not a time-space event. You can't show it by an arrow. he really gets into that over and over. In chapter 2, he talks about the loss of the creature, and I'm just going to have time to do a little bit from this, and then we'll have to do a break for those who want to go eat ice cream and whatever happens after that. This chapter 2, the loss of the creature, he starts out by saying, talking about the Grand Canyon. Says, okay, there was a man, Garcia Lopez de Cardenas. He discovered the Grand Canyon and was amazed at the sight. It can be imagined. One crosses miles of desert, breaks through the mesquite, and there it is at one's feet. Later, the government sets the place aside as a national park, hoping to pass along to millions the experience of Cardenas. Does not one see the same sight from the Bright Angel Lodge that Cardenas saw? The assumption is that the Grand Canyon is a remarkably interesting and beautiful place, and that if it had a certain value P for Cardenas, the same value P may be transmitted to any number of sightseers. A counter influence is at work, however, and it would be near the truth to say that if the place is seen by a million sightseers, a single sightseer does not receive value P, but a millionth part of value P. Now, he then says, what happens is that, you know, before you go to the Grand Canyon, you've seen it on a picture postcard, it's been described to you by friends, you have wishes, hopes, and pictures of what it's going to be. And boy, it better be that. And if it isn't, you're disappointed. And if it is, you go, wow, it's fantastic. It's just, you know, what I hoped. Or it's greater than I hoped, even. Says the highest point, the term of the sightseer's satisfaction, is the measuring up of the thing to the criterion of the preformed symbolic complex. So the Grand Canyon cannot simply be gone and seen, but it has to be recovered. It has to be recovered. The highest point, the term of the sightseer's satisfaction, is the measuring up of the thing to the criterion of the preformed symbolic complex. And he gives another example. A guy is in France, and he's gone to the restaurants, and he's seen the sights, and he's sitting in a cafe waiting for the ship to come that's going to take him home, and there are some students in there arguing about a play, and the argument gets out of hand. And, you know, and a fight ensues, and the woman who runs the place grabs a mop and tries to chase him out of there, you know. And the man is delighted. He's absolutely delighted. This is it. This is really France. See? Well, why is it that? Because he read books about France, and he formed a picture of France, and that was it. You know, the volatile temperament and the excitement of the discussion in the cafe and all that. He said if he hadn't had that idea of France, he would have been, you know, he would have been frightened, or he would have been disgusted by this display and things getting out of hand. But no, this is it, because, you know, that's what France is supposed to be. And he's ecstatic, and he goes home thinking, wow, I just about didn't see it. He's been in France all his time, right? How can the sightseer recover the Grand Canyon? One, it may be recovered by leaving the beaten track. You can go out and, you know, camp behind a bunch of mesquite bushes, and in the morning before dawn, you walk to some place, you know, and you look out over the canyon. Number two, you can be in the same place with the other people, but you can sort of look at them looking at the canyon. You try to transcend the tiredness of it by somehow accepting the tiredness of it. And he said, this is what the New Yorker magazine does. And he said, this guy is extremely fatigued by the thought of, you know, having to go out and try to get off the beaten track. That just doesn't make it, you know, because something else is happening. It can be recovered, he said, if maybe there was suddenly an epidemic and the whole place was cleared out, but one family somehow escaped the net and they're at the Grand Canyon all by themselves. You know? And they'll say, we had it all to ourselves. Remember when I was in Yellowstone Park, the only time I was there, it was in late fall. And I'd go in, there'd be a parking lot that would hold maybe 300 cars or something, and there'd be three cars or four or five cars, you know. And I walked around and I really felt like I owned the place, you know. And it was great. And that's what he's talking about, getting the sovereignty of the experience back, yeah, reclaiming it.
The Grand Canyon.
It's great. In a way, what he's doing there is he's looking through the tiredness to the freshness. I mean, Howard Johnson, you know, a chain. And yet it's closed down, it's out where nothing is happening anymore. And he's in Howard Johnson's, which, you know, what could be more everyday, what could be more sort of a cliche. And yet the place is fantastic in its strangeness, because there's no one else there, and it becomes a fortress. It's funny. Yeah, well, there's some others there. Yeah. Don't want to spoil a book for you all. And then finally he says the last way the Grand Canyon can be recovered is in a time of national disaster. He says, the Bright Angel Lodge is converted into a rest home, a function that has nothing to do with the canyon a few yards away. A wounded man is brought in. He regains consciousness. There outside his window is the canyon. You know? Wow. Or in Huxley, people are, you know, they're surviving the Great War, and an expedition from Australia lands in Southern California and heads east. They stumble across the Bright Angel Lodge, now fallen into ruins. The trails are growing over, the guardrails falling away, the dime telescope at Battleship Point rusted. But there's the canyon, exposed at last. Exposed by what? By the decay of those facilities which were designed to help the sightseer. Now he says, now we try to recover things. So we go to Mexico, try to shorten this up. We go to Mexico, and you get to this plaza somewhere, and you're going to be in Mexico, and you're surrounded by five other couples from Iowa, and you go, ugh, you know, is there no escape? You know? So in disgust, you decide to go to Mexico City, where at least you can, you know, do some of the things you know how to do already. You don't have to go to Mexico for it. But on the way, you get lost, and you end up in this forsaken village. You mean you know the road stops, and you know you're thirsty, and you walk along the trail, and you come to this village. And not only is it off the track, not only are there no Iowans there or anybody else but the villagers, but it's the week when they're doing a corn dance to get it to rain or something, you know, and you go and you just, you know, and you're welcomed, and you watch all this going on, and you go, fantastic. But then he says, you're sort of bothered. You say things like, this is too good to be true. And he says, these people to whom this happens show by their anxiety that they're afraid that it may not be so perfect. And in one place he says, you know, you're afraid all the time that someone from Iowa might step out of one of the houses, you know, and you know, the whole thing will fall into ruins, you know. And you go home and you get your friend who is an ethnologist, and you say, you've got to come see this place with us. And you go back. And the whole time you're there, you don't pay any attention to the village. You watch your ethnologist friend, and you see how taken up he is by this whole thing. And he's affirming it like crazy, you know, and he's watching it all. And you go, it's true, it's real, you know. This ethnologist is fascinated by it. And now this experience has the stamp of approval. You know, it's been made real. Because the expert has, you know, said yes. And now the thing is in the bag. And he says, you know, the sovereignty of the experience is lost. It's not possible for these people to simply be there in that village, with or without their friends from Iowa, and to see what's going on. But it's the necessity to get a hold of something, you know, for myself. In one place later on, he talks about, he said, well, maybe I can find it. This hunger. Now, I can't, apparently I won't be able to find it now, but he says that we're afraid we become invisible. And it's why we take photographs. Maybe it's not toward the beginning. Can't find it. He says that we've lost the possibility to say anything in this day because of the split between objective consciousness, which is the ethnologist in the village, you know. I mean, he's looking at the village, he's observing it, he's interested in it, you know, but we, who brought him there, don't look at the village with him, but we look to him. And when he's satisfied, then we're happy. Now, we have to go through that mediation. What can we say? On the other hand, all the rest of the stuff that's addressed to us is addressed to us in the sense that we have needs and are the, you know, they're being satisfied. Let me sell you this. Or the government may wish to give you that or something like that. And even the scientist, when he looks at us, he would say, they have needs. And among these needs are the need for a myth, maybe, you know, to anchor their lives in. The scientist is looking at man as an objective, you know, in an objective way, as an organism. But he himself is existing outside of that picture. He has to, in order to be objective. He's got to get himself out of the picture. It's a requirement of the method. So then, in doing that, he sort of negates what he's saying about us, because he himself is in that same situation. Becker, even, I think, gets into this bind, where he says, we need an illusion. We need an illusion to live by, he'll say. And finally he'll say, the God illusion is the best one. I'm sort of paraphrasing. But he himself can't buy that, you know, because he knows it's an illusion. So what's he going to do? He's caught. And Percy would say, science is caught in that bind. And so then he goes on to talk about the development of a new science, what he calls a radical anthropology, for a radical existence of the bothness. And Becker does talk about that, how we're both godlike and also very much, you know, organism.
And a connection there that, from what you said before, there's the scientific method, and we're consumers on this level, and that in a sense we're consuming opinion, and we consume opinion, and it reminds me of a quotation that's meant for the sarcastic tone by W. Turner, a friend of the atheist, and said he's using the word intellectual as a negative term, and we had an unusual take on it. An intellectual is one who has managed to find a way of having ideas without active use of the intellect. Now, that flips the normal pejorative use of intellectual over to those who consume ideas. And it is exactly what you're saying.
That just ties in perfectly, you know, with what he's doing here. The scientist himself is banished from sovereignty by his entrapment in the system, if he is entrapped. He doesn't say that every scientist is, you know, is hopelessly caught. He quotes, you know, with approval as well as disapproval. And obviously he's not the first person to have discovered this problem, but...
An interesting thing, that there was a show on PBS, you can see lately, will be re-shown, I'm sure, along this summer. It's called The Origins of the Universe, and in that, I was just dancing because the latest of many, many discoveries have just been made in the nature of the atom and the particles in the atom, and they've just blown it down way down deeper than they've ever had it before, and they've done it by aesthetic and imaginative principles. Instead of making a model to show what they found, they made the improved model and then went after to find if there was anything there on the more aesthetic model, and they found, and they went just drove the level way down, like double the depth that we've gone into the atom in a period of a year, 100 years. And they had the scientists who were talking about this were like kids. They were dancing and laughing, and it was the first group who actually weren't afraid to show their method. They didn't use the computers until later. Their method was one which was basically an anti-surf aesthetic, and they ended up, they think they got it down to the bottom, and they called that particle charm.
Charm.
I was just sitting here just grinning, you know, laughing and celebrating this. And they were too. That was a neat thing. They were just joy of kind of discovery, and it took that from rather.
He says that there is a much better chance that being on an island and a dogfish happen to be up on the shore, and you don't have anything to look at it with but just a bobby pin or a pocket knife or something, the chances are immeasurably greater that you'll learn something about it than if you're in the zoology laboratory at a university and you're handed the dogfish. Let's see, where is he? You're given, you know, you've got the dissecting board, and you've got the, you know, the, there. You've got one dissecting board, one scalpel, one forceps, one probe, one bottle Indi ink and syringe, one specimen of Squalus acanthias, which is the dogfish, forgive my pronunciation, but he said that the problem is that the dogfish is described by its, you know, it's a specimen of something, and he says, here you are, the dogfish itself, the fish itself, is seen as a rather shabby expression of an ideal reality.
Yeah, you know? That's
what
he's picking up there, maybe that it's unnamed.
It's what?
It's unnamed. You know, whereas what he was talking about with only color was the naming thing, when you're given a specimen of a dogfish, in a way, instead of saying this is a dogfish, this is a specimen, it's maybe to unname.
That's interesting, yeah. I think you might be right. It does. It does. Well, it's a little after 9, and ice cream and all that was going to happen, so probably people want to go do that. I got even less into the book than I hoped. I don't know. I sort of, you know, didn't follow what I was thinking of at all, because time went so fast. So, if, you know, I'd be very willing to pick it up again, or if, you know, if you want to ask any questions or anything, for those that don't want to go have ice cream, fine, whatever. Is it worth picking? Oh. Go ahead.
About what were you saying about the scientist standing outside his own method?
As a man who asserts things, and in asserting them, does it for someone else. I mean, a scientist doesn't formulate his things in a vacuum. Even he says Robinson Crusoe, when he wrote in his journal, was writing for someone else, even though he had no idea perhaps if there'd ever be someone else to read it. So he says that requires intersubjectivity. You're writing for the person who has a chance of understanding you. And you assert something, and that person looks at the same picture, you hope, and understands your assertion about it. So there's a sort of a tetrad, a four-sided figure. Here's me, here's the thing that I'm talking about, here's what I'm saying about it, here's you. But science can't itself talk about what happens. It cannot explain why it is or what it is that happens when we name something. And that's the active language, he says. But science itself is not dealing with that. Because it talks about things as a function of something else. Something is caused by something else, right? E equals a function of C. There's a cause. You treat with that cause in a certain way, you know, something happens and a result. No? And you draw arrow from the cause through some sort of a, you know, event that mediates it out to some result. That's what science deals with. And someone else can take that same cause, do the same thing, and get the same result. But the scientist making his assertion about that experiment, you know, writing it up or speaking it to the other scientist, who then gets, you know, gets that water happening and goes, yeah, I understand what you're saying, you know, and then he goes to do it, Well, when he goes and does it, that's fine. They can talk about, you know, science can deal with that. But the thing that happened when those two people got together and understood each other, they can't talk about it. He is amazed that he says, you try to talk about meaning with linguists, with all these semanticists and all these, you know, and people who study the formation of words and syntax and all that stuff. None of them will talk with you about meaning because it's too slippery, you know. But yet the scientist, when he talks about that thing, when he makes an assertion, is dealing in meaning.